Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and thanks for being with us tonight. Tonight I have with us Dr. Andrew Rosenberg, and we're going to talk about some gene snippets, relating to methylation. Is that the right way to say it, Dr. Rosenberg? You know, everyone,
yes.
We always talk about MTHFR, but we're going to expand a little bit tonight. So thank you for taking time to be with us. And if you don't mind, before we get started, tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you.
Absolutely, Eva, and I just want to, thank you for inviting me onto your show and, share with your audience that, the reason we're having a conversation tonight is to empower people and help educate them about their own health and their own body. I really believe that doctors have an obligation not just to treat but to teach people, and I think change from everything that I've studied in my life comes from individuals making better choices, and I really hope that that's, one of the takeaways people get from this conversation. I'm a chiropractor. That's my that was originally what drew me into healthcare and alternative medicine. I believe that the philosophy that the body heals itself and that there's a cause to everything that the body does, that has always just resonated with me on a very deep level. So I think that's one of the driving forces that has, propelled me into trying to look at why people get sick. And when I was going through school, I attended a lot of seminars, so I got to see not just what what's being taught in class, of course, but what are the best and smartest doctors in the world doing? What are they talking about? What are the trends? What's this kind of the state of the art? And so I had an opportunity to view that world, and I came across methylation in that work that I did. And so that's really kind of what brings me into the looking at genetics is, aside from trying to diagnose why someone has back pain or crippling neck pain or all these other issues that chiropractors see. I mean, chiropractors are doctors who see people, and people are complex. They've got emotional injuries, they've got toxic overload, they've been on antibiotics their whole life, and all these factors kind of coalesce and into why we go to a doctor's office. So that's an important background for me, trying to understand why people get sick, why are people anxious, why do people have chronic pain and insomnia and these symptoms that we're coming up over and over again. And so that's, in my opinion, and the way that I've, been able to help people, looking at your genetic polymorphisms. Eva, as you mentioned earlier, some people call them SNPs, and that's just an abbreviation and an acronym for single nucleotide polymorphism. So that's kind of a whole lot of syllables. Just calling them SNPs is a lot easier. That's really what I'm excited to share with your audience tonight is giving them a new way to look at their genetics and to understand that, your genes are your tendency, but they are not your destiny. And I really want to emphasize that point, and hopefully by the end of the hour, they'll have some perspective on that.
Well, before we get started, I just want to say, even though Dr. Rosenberg is a healthcare professional, he is not attempting to treat or diagnose anyone. So anything that you pick up from this show tonight, please be sure and go to your healthcare professional to seek treatment. Or, of course, you can always contact Dr. Rosenberg and go to his clinic. But tonight is for informational purposes only. Just want to make sure that's clear so nobody gets on to us. Anyway, so where can people find you?
Yeah, you did ask me that earlier. I'm on the web. I've got a very popular YouTube channel. We've been putting videos out about methylation for about 16, 17 months now. We have about 250,000 views. So there's something, there's some definitely some interest in that topic. But my real project, my research project, where I put all of my analysis and research and videos, is called BeyondMTHFR.com. When people first hear MTHFR, they think it's an abbreviation for something else, and we always get a chuckle out of that. But it really is, it really is the mother of all genetic problems, as we could say. But and so that's kind of why I named it after that gene, just since that gene is kind of where I started on this journey, learning about it, and it is a very, very important one. But as we'll come to find out tonight, it's certainly not, by no means the only one that we need to learn to appreciate. So that's BeyondMTHFR.com, and I also have a clinic in Boise, Idaho, where I see, you know, patients 5 days a week in person, and that is RedMountainClinic.com. So those are the two best ways to find out more about my project, my research, and my clinic. So.
Excellent. Well, I told you tonight that I wanted to talk about the COMT gene and CBS, but I actually mean the COMT and the BHMT. That's what I... We can talk about anything, but I want to make sure we cover those, because so many people probably have those but don't realize it, and all they hear about is MTHFR. So why don't you start out by telling us what COMT is?
I'd be happy to, you know, and I think you're right on the money. Look, you know, encouraging your audience to look outside of MTHFR, and you know, the whole point of, you know, looking into this research is to understand why certain people get sick. Why do certain people get stressed out, and you know, they go through a stressful event, a divorce, or some other kind of traumatic scenario. Emotional, it could be physical, it could be chemical, it could be, you know, they remodeled a building and they were, you know, they were working in it, and all of a sudden after the remodel, they, all those chemicals they use in new construction, and they're chronically sick and they're fatigued. You know, why does this happen, and why does it happen to only a certain percentage of the people who are exposed? And that, and that's always a question that has you know, driven me to find answers. So When we look at genetics, as I've said before, and I hope your audience, you know, doesn't hold this against me, I will repeat myself, and I want people to know that your genes are not your destiny, but they are your tendency. And they're not your tendency when you're at your healthiest, best, you know, most optimum diet, most optimum stress level, taking wonderful, beautiful care of yourself. That's not when your genes are going to show up to, you know, rock the boat. What will happen is your body will experience some form of stress. It will be either physical, you know, you're training for a marathon, emotional, as I mentioned before, you know, perhaps you move across the country and start, you know, you have your first child at the same time and you're taking on a new job in a new town. I mean, there's lots of different emotional stressors, and then it could be chemical, as I've mentioned also. So those are the stressors that will provoke our genetic imbalance. And so that's really where the value of this research comes in, because we can start to articulate and explain why certain people go through certain symptoms. And I just find it so rewarding when we can connect the dots. So one of the areas that's really important to understand when you're looking at genetics is to realize that when you have a gene encodes a protein. That's all a gene really is just a blueprint to make a certain protein. When you have a change in your genetic code, what we will, what Eva and I will talk about, and what other researchers and you know, what other outlets on the internet, other articles are talking about, when you hear the polymorphism word, when you hear the single nucleotide polymorphism, the SNP, what we're talking about is that the genetic code to making the protein has changed a little bit. So it just changes slightly the shape of the protein. So if you change the instructions on the AutoCAD file that's inside of your cells, inside the blueprint, and then they build the structure will look pretty close to what it was supposed to look like, but instead of a square window, you get a big round window on that side of your house. I mean, that's just, you know, one kind of way to look at this. So, I mean, and many of your audience members are already maybe familiar with this. I just want to point out that's really what this SNP is. It's just a change in the shape of a protein, of an enzyme. And so from a chiropractic point of view, kind of backing up real quick, a little bit about why this caught my interest so much was we were, you know, going through school doing x-rays and studying, you know, what's normal symmetry of the human body and all these different things that are out there in the population, like spina bifida and other defects, you know, people born with scoliosis, born with an extra vertebrae. I'm like, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, they call these normal variants, but they're not normal. They're just common. And so we give them a label, normal variant, but it's still a variant from what it should be. And I'm like, why is this? Why do some people have an extra vertebrae? Why do some people have spina bifida? And that's really where I entered the rabbit hole of looking at genetics, because I was like, okay, there's things going on genetically that are literally changing the shape of people's bodies as adults or even younger. So that's a fascinating connection, I think, between the fact that genes change the shape of proteins, but they also literally can change the shape of your entire body. That's just something to keep in mind.
It's so interesting, isn't it? I didn't realize that that's what it does, that it adds an extra vertebrae.
It could. So
is that the MTHFR one?
Yeah, it could. So
it makes
without
sense
getting
to me,
too. Yeah, so even I want to answer your questions about COMT. I think that's like such an important gene. But I just to give a little more background on the physical shape idea is that they did studies where they took a white blood cell from a person, and they took a couple of them actually, and they put them into petri dishes. And so these are called the in vitro studies where they're done in a petri dish, not done inside of a body. And they created a situation in the petri dish where one petri dish had all of the nutrition that was required for a cell to divide in a healthy way. And one of the main nutrients that's needed is B9. It's a methyl group. It's kind of the folate that's needed, and that's what MTHFR activates, is it activates B9 and allows it to become available for the cell to use for cell division and growth. That's one big area that MTHFR helps with. And so they made sure that one of the petri dishes had that in there. And now the other petri dish didn't. They basically created a nutritional deficiency inside the petri dish. And then they allowed these cells to divide. So I don't know how long it took for the white blood cell to go through its cell cycle and, you know, double the amount of, you know, chromosomes and go through the cell division process. But incredibly, what happened was the cells that divided inside the petri dish with all the nutrition and the methyl groups in that dish just created a perfect daughter cell, a beautiful, perfect white blood cell, just like the parent. But in the other petri dish where the deficiency was, where there was a methylation deficiency created by the scientists, the daughter cell actually was created Down syndrome. I mean, that was a huge insight. So they basically created an incorrect number of chromosomes in the cell that divided by taking away methyl groups. So you can see
that
even at a
study. Do you remember who did that study?
I can look it up for you as we're talking. I can. It's a white blood cell study. I'll get it for you.
I just want the listeners to be able to go look at it if they want to.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'll try to, as I'm talking here, I'll try to throw those nuggets out for everybody to look at. But so that's at a cellular level. So then at a physical level, many of your listeners are aware that they fortified food. They fortified, white flour, which is pretty nutritionally deficient after the processing of it with all the bran and everything removed. And so they began the fortification of flour to prevent birth defects, and it was actually effective. Even though they used folic acid, it was still very effective at preventing birth defects. And so that extra vertebrae we're talking about, they did another study where they took mice and they created a folate deficiency in the mom. And when the baby mouse was born, it had extra vertebrae in the tail, just like someone born with scoliosis. And so it basically comes down to this idea that the methylation cycle is so important. It's so fundamental to life itself that if it becomes slowed down or stressed, you'll have changes in so many different downstream systems. And, you know, that kind of relationship, you know, should empower us to say, okay, we should really understand methylation, because once we get it right, it makes all these other things work really well.
So did you say that using folic acid caused scoliosis? I just want to make sure I understood that correctly.
Well, what the researchers in that study did was they actually took, kind of like the white blood cell study, they took a pregnant mouse mom and they removed methylation support from her diet. And when she gave birth to her pups, they had an extra vertebra, they had incorrect skeletal symmetry.
From folic acid, right?
Well, actually from not having any folate, no folic acid.
Oh, okay.
They weren't giving any, yeah. So they were.
Oh, okay. What do you say about folic acid?
Well,
I'm not a proponent of folic acid, so that's why I'm
sure. And I'm not a proponent either. And I was kind of on the bandwagon that, you know, folic acid was this horrible thing that mankind had invented. And it's actually a little more nuanced than that. And we can, you know, some of the research we use in our office highlights how people who have gut infections with a lot of extra bacteria, especially the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, SIBO, they actually, one of the diagnostic features of that condition is high levels of folic acid in their bloodstream. And this is in people who do not supplement with folic acid. So the question would be, where does it come from? And it actually, our gut bacteria can poop out folic acid. So we've always had some folic acid in our body. We've just never been supplementing with it like we have been over the past, say, 30 or 40 years. So folic acid is not the best form of folate for us to take. I'm in totally in agreement with that. I mean, it's not the best.
I think it gave me a heart attack.
It can
I
do that.
I don't normally listen to other people because I found that other people don't usually know as much as me because they don't have the opportunity to pick brains like, you know, yours and Amy Yatsko and Steve Sinatra, and, you know, they don't have that opportunity, so the average person usually doesn't know. And I let somebody tell me to use their product one time, and it was like this ridiculously expensive product, $85 for this bottle of vitamins, and she said it was the best before, and they want to know now. She was having me take 15 of those things a day for a mood disorder. Well, my homocysteine went off the chart because it was full of folic acid and other synthetic vitamins, and I had a big heart attack. And I'm convinced that's why it was.
Yeah,
because I stopped taking it, and I don't have the problem with it going up anymore. I'm convinced that. Well, I forgot to tell you, I have double mutations of MTHFR, so, you know, I think I'm just not a good big proponent of it. Anyway.
No, I'm not either. I mean, you know, they're giving 4 milligrams a day of folic acid to women who have recurrent miscarriages, and it's just, it's not the right approach. And that, you know, again, we're not giving audience members medical advice by any means, but what I will share with everyone is, you know, in my practice, I rarely give anyone more than 2, maybe maximum 3 milligrams a day of folate. You just, when there's other things, there's other ways to support methylation aside from just giving B9 and high doses. There's so many other things that are important.
So I don't want to go down this wagon, this hole here, but we just use the word folic acid, then we use the word folate. So
sure.
Are we talking about folic acid, or are we talking about a methylated folate?
So for all intents and purposes, for this conversation and in any of the research literature that I write or put out there, folic acid would indicate the synthetic type of folate that has to be activated by MTHFR. And so therein lies the problem for individuals like myself and members of my family, and I'm sure many of your audience members, that when you expose yourself to high levels of folic acid, whether it is from a supplement, as you've said, or as I've shared with, when you have a gut infection, the gut bacteria itself can produce massive amounts of folic acid, chemically identical to the stuff that they fortify food with. I mean, it was a big eye-opening research finding that happened. whether or not, regardless of the source of the folic acid, high levels of folic acid can drive people into, as you describe, severe cardiovascular symptoms, tachycardia, high blood pressure, headaches, insomnia. And I want to think this is a good time now to kind of tie in the COMT into this, because this is all going to kind of segue really well.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Yeah. So we've talked about genes. Genes make proteins / enzymes. Well, COMT is a really important enzyme, and it stands for catechol-O-methyltransferase. So, I'm not an organic chemist. I'd read a ton of biochemistry, but the catechol is the shape of the molecule, and then the methyltransferase part of it is, moving a methyl group into that chemical bond, into that molecule. And it's a way to transform something to basically detoxify it. What you should think of COMT as, you should think of COMT as part of your detoxification system. It's really not part of your growth and repair. It's just not part of that. MTHFR is part of growth and repair. It sits differently, located a little differently in our methylation cycle chemistry. But COMT is really a very important detoxification enzyme. And the reason why it's so important, and the reason I think your listeners are going to find that this is, meaningful to them, is COMT breaks down your stress neurotransmitters. So it breaks down catecholamines. And catecholamines are known to the layperson as adrenaline and dopamine. So those chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline, in my opinion, the way we work with patients, they're the most potent chemicals in our body. I mean, they drive so much behavior, and they drive so much of how we feel every day, that if we can think of the basic reason why someone goes to a doctor is because they don't feel well, then we want to look at chemistry that's affecting how they're feeling. MTHFR plays a role, don't get me wrong, but the COMT system is really where individuals begin to get into different groups of categories of who's prone to anxiety, who's prone to depression, who's prone to having substance abuse problems, who's prone to panic or excessive worry, who's prone to having cravings and going through high-risk behavior, and who's prone to having chronic pain and insomnia. And what I'm describing in these two groups is, on one hand, you have people with low dopamine. They tend to have low dopamine function for different reasons. There's lifestyle factors. I mean, it's an important conversation. It's one we have every day in our office. But digestion, the state and function of the gut causes low dopamine in a lot of different individuals. And that person has cravings. That person has, substance abuse, high-risk behavior. Grumpy. Guys are grumpy a lot. Well, guys get a lot of low dopamine because of testosterone, and testosterone can influence our COMT system. So on the low end of COMT, when people have low catecholamines, when the COMT system is going too fast, or when the COM, or when they're just having other problems that are kind of wrapped up in this situation, you can figure out who has low dopamine by the following symptoms, and I'll just repeat them one more time. So someone gets really grumpy when they don't eat. They get angry and frustrated. They their personality changes between meals. They're prone to kind of throwing fits, whether they're a toddler or an adult acting like a toddler. Substance abuse problems, gambling, addictions. And really what I'm describing is someone whose dopamine is dropping, and they're trying to do – they're reacting to low dopamine to do things to raise it. So high-risk behavior, going out and, racing cars and shooting guns and trying to climb mountains, those are what adrenaline junkies do. And adrenaline junkies need their fix. They need their dopamine. And so that's an important part of understanding COMT. So I kind of try to, when I educate people about COMT, I want you to imagine a bell curve with symptoms on the left where the dopamine is too low at that period of time. It may be for part of the day, or it may be all the time. And then on the other end of the curve, you have high catecholamines and high dopamine. You end up with anxiety, panic, worry, insomnia, chronic pain develop. You get all kinds of digestive disturbances from this. And on the very, very far right side of this bell curve, you will see mania and you'll see schizophrenia. And it all relates back to COMT because COMT controls how fast dopamine is broken down. So without you know, giving too much information or kind of, you know, drinking too much from the fire hydrant here, when we talk about COMT, as Eva has said, it's a SNP like other SNPs, and it can be, you can be born with a slow one or what we call a wild type, which would be compared to the slow person, sometimes it's discussed like the COMT is going faster, but it's really, that's inaccurate. COMT is either going normal speed or really slow. There's not really a faster version out there. That's important to understand. So you either get the average enzyme that can shift into fourth gear, or you get the one that shifts into third gear, or you get the one that shifts into second gear. And anybody who's ever driven a five-speed knows that if you want to go faster, fourth gear is, you know, that's a lot better. So
let me ask a question here.
Sure.
And I don't want to go too far on this because I want you to have time, but if, let's say, I have plus-plus COMTs, does that mean that's fourth gear? What does that mean to somebody who looks at their genetic test? Would that be plus-plus or plus-minus or minus? What are they looking at when they see those things?
So when you see plus-plus, what you are looking at is a reduction in enzyme speed. You're looking at someone who's born who can only get into second gear. If you're plus-minus, and you're yellow, you know, and again, I should point out that the report that I work the most with and the organization that I think has done a really good job raising awareness about methylation issues is Sterling Hill and her 23andMe app. So just kind of plugging her because I think they have done a really good job of raising awareness. So I get all those reports that are nice color-coded. I'm either looking at, you know, red, yellow, or green. So if you're plus-plus, you're... Yep, perfect. So if you're the plus-plus is a reduction in speed. For the COMT, and again, the report will have maybe 20, not 20 quite yet. It has about 12 to 16 COMT genes, and that can get a little confusing. What you do is you just treat it like a group, and you look at the whole group, and you go, okay, out of 12 genes, I've got 9 of them that are not green, and, you know, 5 of them are red and 4 are yellow. Well, that puts you in the category where you're born with a slower COMT system, all things being equal. All things being equal, that individual who's plus-plus for COMT has a reduced speed of that enzyme. And therefore, all things being equal, when something stressful happens, that adrenaline that's released by the body and the dopamine that's created from digestive process and all the other, you know, elegant processes that control neurotransmitters in your brain, that dopamine and those stress hormones like adrenaline will be in your body longer. They will be in your body longer. And so it's a gift under unstressful circumstances because people who are plus-plus, as I've shown on my website, you know, interested parties who are listening to your show, if you go to beyondnthfr.com, I've got some really great articles, I think, that explain this over and over again. So if you wanted to learn more about it, that's a good resource to look at. But people who are born with plus-plus on their COMT are going to have, under unstressful conditions, under a very healthy society, a non-toxic world, where they're just focused on one or maybe two things at a time, they actually have a higher rate of learning. They have a better memory. You might describe them as more intelligent, more detail-oriented. And that's a side effect of what dopamine does for your brain. So if you're born with a tendency to break dopamine and adrenaline down slower, the tendency will be that you have more of it in your brain longer. Does that make sense? That's an important concept. So
yes.
Individuals with COMT plus-plus who have this elevated dopamine, what they've been able to study and basically prove is when you have, like I mentioned, one or maybe two things that you're stressed about or worried about or working on, you do really, really well because you're born in the middle of the bell curve, like just getting out of bed in the morning on vacation in paradise with COMT++, you've got an optimum level of dopamine in your brain. Whereas somebody else born with COMT negative negative, they actually have to stress themselves out to get their dopamine up to the level of somebody who's plus plus. And again, this may be a little hard for your listeners to visualize, and so I've actually put these pictures, these bell curves, onto my website, so that would be a good visual aid. But what I'm describing is that individuals, when you look at the comp system, you're looking at stress tolerance. That's really what you need to understand. You're looking at the tolerance for catecholamines, the tolerance for stress. And so people who are born plus plus, and I'm, you know, married to a wonderful woman who's plus plus, and she's extremely smart, very, very intelligent person. And you'll find that people who are plus plus are some of the smartest people you ever meet, but they also have an Achilles heel. It's like a double-edged sword. The extra dopamine that you have because your COMT system's going slower literally makes you sharper, like I mentioned, better memory, better learning, and this has been proven scientifically. But it also makes you susceptible to being overloaded with adrenaline if the stressors kind of coalesce and they kind of build. So really stressful experiences are harder on these people. And I think there's a lot of value in doctors understanding that and looking at COMT, because the good news is there are great things we can do to actually change the environment inside the body, and that it actually changes the speed of the COMT system.
So that's where I want to go right now. I'm a talker kind of, and I talk to everybody I know and to give them information, like on this radio show. I have two people listening tonight that I know. One of them has COMT problems and they have addiction problems, and the other one has COMT problems and profound anxiety and sometimes self-mutilation problems.
Mm.
So for those kinds of problems, how can they use nutrition to help? What are some tips that, and again, we're not trying to treat or diagnose, but what are some things that people can possibly do at home to help these kinds of problems?
Great question, Eva, and I think, you know,
is it worded safely enough?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, we're not treating anyone. What we're doing is we're educating about principles, and you know, that's an empowering thing for individuals to learn the buttons that you can push to make things change. I mean, that's what we're all about. So, in this research to understand COMT, what I was curious was about is, you know, I understand that genes are important, as I mentioned, in you know, clearly that they're very important, but it really is the environment that rules the roost. And so what are the things that exist in our environment inside of our body that really antagonize COMT? What could possibly make it worse? And then on the other side of the coin, what could make it better? And when an individual is going through, let's say, a high anxiety period, what we want to do is look at areas of their physiology that could be impacting the COMT system and really slowing it down even more. So in other words, we want to speed the COMT system up in an individual who's showing signs of catecholamine excess, chronic pain, insomnia, worry, panic, anxiety, no tolerance for stress. Every day they wake up and their bucket that holds stress is already at the very top. Anything else starts splashing out. You start getting all these symptoms. So that individual, the plus plus COMT, you want to look at two things. What I've learned, you know, in treating, you know, thousands of patients is that when you're trying to understand why people go through these really difficult stress responses, they have these chronic negative reactions to stress, you want to look at the gut. And doctors way smarter than me and way before me have always said, you know, health begins in the gut, it's all about gut, gut, gut. But we really know now why that's so true, especially for COMT. So gut bacteria and yeast as well, but mainly gut bacteria poop out chemicals that our liver has to detoxify. And that's normal. It's normal for that to go on at some background level. But what we find is people are they're on antibiotics too much. They have been addicted to standard American food. They got an infection when they were born in the hospital, and they had IV antibiotics. They had tubes put in their ears. You know, they had chronic sinus infections, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a huge, I mean, there's millions and millions of people out there who have been very damaged by antibiotics. I think to some degree we all have been. And what the antibiotics create is an overgrowth of aggressive bacteria and good bacteria as well, but often it's the aggressive bacteria. And those, that excess of bacteria in the gut, similar to what we said earlier, SIBO, is pooping out chemicals that is leaking into the body, and it's sort of sitting in the exact same parking space as adrenaline. So in the COMT enzyme, there's one parking space, and it says reserved for adrenaline or reserved for dopamine, okay? That's where dopamine sits. That's where adrenaline sits. If another chemical gets there first, then that dopamine and that adrenaline have to drive around the block and circle and wait for that other thing to get out of the way. And so gut problems and gut bacterial overgrowth is really messing with people's COMT system. And so we've got all the research that shows, look, when you inject these polyphenols, and that's just a broad classification. I don't want people to misinterpret me and say that resveratrol is a polyphenol and therefore it's bad for your COMT. I'm really talking about the bacterial phenols that come from your gut. The phenols from your gut will slow down COMT because they're going to hog those parking spaces in your liver. And the COMT gene is expressed mainly in the liver. It is expressed in other parts of your body, but truly it is the liver's, one of the liver's main enzymes. So that is one reason why patients with a lot of anxiety, insomnia, and chronic pain have been responding so well to gut repair and treating the bacterial imbalances. I mean, it's just beautiful when that happens.
Let's talk about that. What do they do?
How do they repair it?
Yes.
Yeah, so there's so much information in our society that, you know, we're overloaded with information, but we're sort of lacking wisdom. You know, it's like you can find anything, but there's no meaning. There's no meaning to the information. So I recognize that, and I'm, you know, I think it's real important that we give everything context. So kombucha, kimchi, sauerkraut, garlic, onions. Very few people would ever say those are bad for you, and I wouldn't either. But I will warn you that if you have an overgrowth of bacteria and you eat those types of prebiotic foods like kefir and all these other things that are really good for bacterial growth, that feed, it's bug food. Bug food is good when you have a normal population of bugs or a low population of bugs and you want to grow them and support them. But if we are trying to reduce a population of bacteria, a different strategy is needed. And what we use in our office is we use a type of specific carbohydrate diet. Other times it's called a FODMAP diet. Some of your listeners will be familiar. A FODMAP, F-O-D-M-A-P, FODMAP.
I've not heard it.
Well, Eva, what FODMAP is it's abbreviation for fructooligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and sugar alcohols. Basically what it is, it's fermentable ingredients in the food. So when you ask, you know, how do we treat the COMT person who's just got way too much dopamine, way too much anxiety, they're going into OCD, they may be diagnosed bipolar. Well, all those diagnoses and labels are just underlying the fact that their COMT system is imbalanced, and then we ask why and what can we do. So when we're working on gut problems of a COMT nature, of the high end, when we're dealing with the elevated catecholamines and elevated adrenaline, we usually are going and trying to kill bacteria. We're not trying to support it. So in other words, I'm just sharing this way to think about it. If we have too much bacteria and we have too much of the wrong kind of bacteria, if we eat garlic and onions and all these really healthy foods that are really good at feeding gut bacteria, it's really, you begin to feed the infection rather than starving it. And so that's why a specific carbohydrate diet is so valuable, the FODMAP diet. You essentially restrict from your diet, and this is something that each individual out there needs to, you know, work with their healthcare practitioner on. You know, we work with this with individuals over the phone with on this process every day. But you need to restrict the foods that are fermentable. And what begins to happen is it's almost like you create a diet that's very nourishing and a lot of nutrients, but it almost acts like an antibiotic. The diet itself begins to reduce the amount of bacteria. It kind of culls the population. So that's part of it. From the food angle, we basically want to starve the extra bacteria so that the body, you know, culls the population and it goes back to a more adequate level. And then we also do a lot of work with betaine HCl for stomach acid. Remember that most, you know, every day practically I hear a story about somebody who got food poisoning. And it wasn't that everybody who ate at the restaurant got food poisoning. It's that one person did. So what are the odds that that's the only person that got the tainted food? You know, pretty low, right?
Mm-hmm.
The difference between people, the inter-individual difference in who gets sick with food poisoning and who doesn't, has everything to do with how their digestive system is working. And the best thing that an individual can do to create an insurance policy that they're digesting well, they can make sure that they make enough stomach acid, because even if the food in the airport when you're running, you know, on a business trip or going on vacation and you're in a hurry and you're eating in a stressed out state of mind, well, that stressed out state of mind right there shuts off your stomach acid. But if you learn to supplement with stomach acid, and I'd say that in my experience, about 90% of people who I recommend it to, in fact, need it and do very well. There is, you know, maybe 5 to 10% of people who have who don't respond well to the stomach acid, and that requires a little different approach. But making sure you get enough stomach acid will kill bacteria in your food, but it also starts to kill bacteria in the gut that's in excess. So I'm just kind of
That's great. And it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, so
it makes perfect sense.
It's all digestion.
I wonder, now that you're talking about, I wasn't really expecting you to talk so much about gut, but now that you are, I'm going to ask you a question. I started using a bunch of probiotics maybe last year, and when I did, that's when I got a really bad gut problem. So I wonder, can people cause their gut to be overflourished when they use probiotics? Maybe is that a right way to say that?
Yeah. So
it makes me. I did a heavy duty probiotic thing that a doctor told me to do, and I did it, and that's what I've been battling for the last 6 months is gut, and I do everything, and I eat a perfect diet. So and the only thing I didn't do was HCl, because the doctor said don't do that. I don't know why, but anyway.
Well, you're exactly right. That remember, I mean, you can have an overgrowth of good bacteria that begins to have a negative impact, and the way it's going to impact you, an individual, is it's going to interfere with the methylation cycle by affecting COMT and MAOA. So when you described how, if I can use this example again, you mentioned earlier about feeling you had like a cardiovascular event from taking methyl groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everyone does, right? That's more of a rare occurrence, but it still happens. You know, certainly in my patient population, it happens pretty often.
It was a lot of folic acid. It was a lot.
Sure. But think about when patients have negative reactions to even small amounts of folic acid or folate or B12, even the right kinds of folate, like the really good methylfolate, 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate, or methyl B12. When you have these strange reactions to B vitamins and it's like, oh man, I got this genetic report, I got all these symptoms like depression and low energy, and I take B vitamins and I get worse. Well, you're looking at the bacteria eating your vitamins first. And it's like these methyl vitamins are basically mitochondrial fertilizer. It's rocket fuel. And whatever we put in our mouth, we only absorb what the bugs don't eat, essentially. So, yes, if you have an imbalanced gut, not enough gut motility, not enough bile function, not enough you know, HCL, you could have, without knowing it, way too much bacteria in your gut. And when you take probiotics, they could make you worse because it's making the high bacterial problem worse. And so for certain mm-hmm. patients, we actually advise them not to take probiotics until we have an understanding that their gut bacteria has returned to a more healthy population. And then the probiotics, again, your probiotics are going to respond really well to the environment that they're in. So we can change the environment in the gut, and it will promote the growth and the survival of the really good probiotics. But if the gut environment is more hostile and the pH isn't correct and the right, you know, the sequencing of this gut isn't correct, then you can't, you won't see the same results. So I want to also point out, you know, that your gut really is a muscle. I mean, it's essentially one muscle from the lips to the other end. It's 26 feet long. And it's all just different kinds of, you know, incredible, muscles. The stomach's a muscle. The gallbladder squeezes. It's a muscle. Your whole small intestine, large intestine. I mean, it's muscle function. And so,
We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to ask
sure.
you: what is the role in, like, sodium, potassium, butyrate in that gut? And that whole, because I notice when I take sodium potassium butyrate, my gut's a lot better. But yesterday I ran out, so today I took sodium potassium bicarb, and as soon as I put something in my mouth, it kills me. What's the role there?
Well, my understanding is that, you know, our good bacteria produce butyric acid, and so we have a need for butyrate to support and kind of feed the cells that line our gut. So, you know, the fact that you feel better with the supplementation would just indicate to me that based on what's living in your gut and the species and the type of metabolism they have, they're not providing enough. You know, and another good sort of source of butyric acid is organic butter and, you know, ghee. So, you know, that's another good source of butyric acid, absolutely. But with the time left, I would like to, you've asked me a couple good questions about individuals who may be listening to this show. You mentioned one who was dealing with addictions, if I remember correctly, and another one who was dealing at some points with self-harm, self-mutilation.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
So everything I've said tonight, you know, this is, you know, thousands and thousands of hours of research and thinking and, you know, just sort of meditating on it and just, you know, being present with these ideas for a long time. So it's not something you just, you know, that's everything in life. You have to practice, 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 and everything gets simpler and simpler and simpler, more crystallized. But I want to share that the CMT problem, someone who's plus-plus with CMT in the same 24 hours can experience the lowest lows of low dopamine and the screaming severe highs of low dopamine. You're not locked in or guaranteed to always have super high dopamine 24 hours a day or super low dopamine, okay? It can waft back and forth. And what you've got to do is just pay close attention to the symptoms. And so somebody who's going through addictions, what they're really struggling with is they're dropping off the low end of the curve, you know, they're scraping bottom in their boat of their dopamine river. And addictions, whatever form they come in, the brain result is always the same. It doesn't matter if it's gambling. It's the basic mechanism behind all addictive behavior is to raise dopamine. And so this gets back into how dopamine is produced. And we cannot many of your listeners know that dopamine is formed from tyrosine or phenylalanine. And those are just simply amino acids that are present in quinoa, beans, lean organic, you know, meat. It's just stuff that we eat. But we cannot bring it into our brain without having it doesn't just diffuse into our brain. It has to get actively transported across the blood-brain barrier. And the only way to assure that this happens in a balanced, healthy way. The basic cure for addictions, the first thing you want to look at is blood sugar, because insulin controls how well tyrosine and phenylalanine, and as well also tryptophan, those three, tryptophan, tyrosine, and phenylalanine, the precursors of serotonin, dopamine, adrenaline, and norepinephrine are completely dependent on insulin levels. And we all know that this country has, we have terrible blood sugar control, and there's a lot of imbalanced blood sugars out there. So that's the first place I would look. And, you know, when we deal with lifestyle factors and helping people, we don't just say, hey, take this supplement and everything will be fine. Like, we want to understand why. We want to change their eating habits, make sure they're digesting well, fix their gut, make sure they eat frequently throughout the day, and do other things necessary to manage that blood sugar. If that doesn't do it all by itself, then usually they'll see some improvement just from that. And that, for 80% of people, that's all you have to do. The other remaining group who still may have some cravings, and I would just like to say that cravings are an addiction pattern. I mean, you're just become suddenly addicted to chocolate or chips or whatever you're craving. That can be helped by taking things that would slow down, inhibit MAO. You know, sometimes we use St. John's wort as a very good craving control. I've gotten very good feedback from that from patients. It works really well. So even though this individual may have COMT++ genes, you can see that based on how they're expressing that, the phenotype is that they're really struggling to have a balanced level of dopamine. So we don't want to just assume, oh, you're COMT++, well, you'll always have high dopamine. Well, that's not true. What the body will do is, if there's too much dopamine, it makes receptors go away. Just like having insulin resistance, you can have dopamine resistance. And it takes more and more and more dopamine to get the same level of clarity and the same level of, you know, being satisfied and calm and all that stuff. So it's just a fascinating relationship there. And then on the other patient that you mentioned, the other individual, they're not a patient, I'm not treating them, the other individual is, self-injury is another mechanism to raise dopamine. I mean, if you want to raise adrenaline, all you have to do is hurt yourself. I don't mean have, you could be in an accident. Yeah, so that's getting into the reason why, and then the question of how we fix it is we've got to go make sure that digestive tract, there's so much research now saying that, you know, they're doing fecal transplants from mice that have anxiety, and they're injecting them into mice that don't have anxiety and giving those mice the exact same problem. And then they're taking mice that are calm and taking their gut bacteria out and putting it into the mice that have anxiety and making the anxiety in the mouse go away. So there
How do you know if the... I've wondered about that. If somebody gets a fecal transplant, how do you know it's safe?
I don't know enough about it. It's just on my radar, you know? It does. And I think that we're going to find a more analog, little bit more like homegrown way to do it without having to go into a clinic and do all this. It seems aggressive is what it does. I really think that there's going to be ways to do it. And one way you can do it, you can do a probiotic enema. That's a way that, if you take it orally, it's got 20 feet to go before it gets into your colon. Or you do a probiotic enema with a little bit of liquid and a probiotic, two or three capsules of probiotic, and then you're right there. So there's been a lot of, we've been using that more often in our office. But, yeah, it's all about
so
gut.
In a minute, what's the difference between doing a probiotic enema and putting it in your mouth?
Well, the probiotic enema would basically skip the digestive tract altogether and just go straight into the colon. Yeah,
okay,
so you just have a higher potency delivery system is essentially what you're doing. But you're not going to be able to repopulate the small intestine that way, right? You're only going to be able to help the colon, basically.
My thing seems to be in the gallbladder, liver, pancreas area, whereas mine bloats out. What could I do for that?
You know, if an individual is bloated, with just eating really healthy, I mean, I'm very suspectful of SIBO.
I eat a perfect diet.
Yeah, people who eat a perfect diet and still have gut symptoms, there's something living in the gut that has to get addressed. And so, there's some testing we recommend for patients. We do a lot of organic acid tests. I love that test because the organic acid test gives me the information about the phenols that I mentioned earlier And it tells I can take an organic acid test and extrapolate it into their brain and liver methylation cycle and get an understanding of how much of their symptoms is due to a gut dysbiosis slowing down their COMT system even more, making them provoking their genetic imbalance. And then as we get the gut under control, then we may see 80% improvement on these other symptoms, but now that the gut's working better, we can use other tools to help refine it. I mean, really the most important question a doctor or practitioner should be asking when a patient walks into their office is, what is the status of this patient's gut? Because everything I say and everything I recommend after that, whether it be diet-oriented, supplement, it will, if that gut is not addressed first, then you get lackluster results. You get contradictory results because you're chewing and swallowing rocket fuel and really good nutrition, but that just goes and feeds the bacteria instead of feeding you. And it becomes frustrating for people.
I've got to stop you there. We have less than a minute.
Sure.
You're coming back next week, right?
I think we set it up for 2 weeks.
That's right, 2 weeks. So come back in 2 weeks and hear Dr. Rosenberg, what else he has to say. Tell us one more time your website, and then we're going to be done for the night. I hate it, but it's the way
it's okay.
It is.
Okay, yeah. You can find out more information about what we spoke of tonight on beyondmthfr.com, and I just thank you all for your time and attention and hope you've gained some value from our conversation tonight.
You do a great job of saying it in layman's terms. You really do. I look forward to having you back in 2 weeks, Dr. Rosenberg. Thank you.
Thank you, Eva. Thanks so much.
Good night.